There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along on this Thursday, and lots to do on the show. Remember, the text line open for you as well at 343-0106. And we will be checking in for new information coming in from our staff meteorologist, Dr. Bill Williams, as we watch. You know, Dr. Bill is not one to hype. Maybe it might be a little different than a lot of people in the weather world in broadcasting, but he's not one to hype, which has been my lament over the years sometimes with him, but it's also given me great confidence. And he said this morning to Dalton and I that possibly, with the way things are tracking right now, we could be looking at two storms. Now, will one be a hurricane, one be a tropical storm, one be a wave, one be a that's not for sure, but we could possibly be looking at two of them in the Gulf by next week. So we'll be getting the latest from Dr. Bill to keep us all in the loop on that, because I think that is of significance for sure. And, of course, he keeps his eye on this all hurricane season long, and we'll get our updates. All right, I mentioned as well this morning the guest, excited about the guest in this hour, joining us from the Mobile County Department of Health, Dr. L. Scott Chavers, new to the Mobile County Health Department, but not new to our area. One of us, except he's spent a little time a couple decades worth of experience in medicine and epidemiology, of course, that we want to talk to him about. And Dr. L. Scott Chavers joins us now on Midday Mobile. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you, Sean. I do appreciate it. And please call me Scott. And listeners, as they call in again, please just call me Scott. I get it's very formal. I love Mobile because of the formality, but I'm just Scott on the radio.
Well, good. We can work it. So I'll be Sean, you be Scott, but you obviously have the information that so many of us are interested here when it comes to COVID-19 and the fight against the virus. But before we do that, let's talk about your, you got a PhD in epidemiology, Master's of Public Health in Epidemiology, Bachelor of Science, Biomedical Science. So you were at South, you went to UAB, right? And then you got your PhD from UAB.
I did. To be honest, that I really had never heard of epidemiology until my senior year at South Alabama. And it was just kind of where everything aligned for me with the medical aspects that go into epidemiology and understanding the disease and the pathology. And as my career progressed, that went from infectious disease to some other therapeutic areas. But also, I'd always had an interest in computers and analytical methods. Believe it or not, epidemiology also brings in some philosophical thinking and logic. And then there are the hardcore core epi methods that are involved. So there's some math involved with what we do and some very complex modeling at some point. But I had never heard of epi there at South. I was doing a biomedical science degree. I was going to go to medical school. And really, for me, the light just clicked. And it was also a great time because there were stories on the news that was talking, you know, where HIV was being highlighted. And that, you know, at that time was just a big, big epidemic. And then there was an Ebola epidemic, and that was, you know, there were movies made about
it.
And so that really kind of spurred me to look into UAB because it had one of the best schools of public health in the country. And I was lucky enough to be accepted and have some scholarships there that it really opened the door for me.
It is interesting. I mean, to choose that. I mean, you were on a track for medical school, and I know a couple of my buddies that are physicians, and how they found their calling within the medical field. But you said yours was, I mean, you hadn't heard of it till your senior year, and
right.
and now here you are, your PhD. You've worked for these giant companies. You've done all this research. That's kind of a trajectory that takes you from zero to 100 pretty darn quickly.
Well, yeah, I've been in it for about 23 years now as the doctor, of epidemiology. And I'll have to tell you, the path wasn't always straight. It was one of those things where doors would open and I saw where I could, in my mind, bring value to the situation. That's one of the reasons I'm here at Mobile County Health Department. And so I would just walk through those doors, and those doors led me into, academia there at UAB, where I was on staff and helped with research and did instruction with School of Public Health, School of Dentistry, and School of Medicine. And then another door opened in industry, but we'll have to talk a little bit about the difference in around epidemiology and industry versus more of the commercial side, because there's a fairly hard line that's there.
And that's defined
in terms of what you're doing.
Meaning that, okay, on one side of the line, it's what kind of work. On the other side of the line, it's what other kind of work. Where's that split?
Yeah. So most of what you see on TV and in print, that's commercial. And the remit of the people that are in commercial is basically to sell the drug. And we have, there are individuals that go and they'll talk to physicians and answer their questions. So those are medical science liaisons. So that is kind of one side of things, but there is a very large area within companies, and this is CRO, contract research organizations. I apologize for the acronym sometimes, but they're, in big pharma, you have the research and development side, the drug safety side. And what epidemiology does in industry is epidemiologists will look at what we call unmet medical needs. So what's going on in the population, and for me, it was global responsibility for infectious diseases, oncology, immunology, vaccines, and what would be called diseases of the developing world. Mm-hmm. So that's things like Ebola, malaria, and drug-resistant tuberculosis, for instance. So my job was to go in, look at what the current issues were, why these things were occurring, work with the local ministers of health, and formulate plans around how to mitigate these issues that they were seeing. So, for instance, with the Ebola outbreak, one of the large drivers of infectivity were around the funerals that were occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were seeing a spread of Ebola from the deceased to, and I'm trying to keep, I know this is the lunch hour, so I'll try to keep this not gross.
Right.
You could see transmission from the deceased to the females in the family, and then the females would spread that to the core family. So it was things like that we would help. And then, of course, having the pharmaceutical side of things, aligning those kind of resources to what the problems are was really, my job. And then on the other side of that, as drugs were being developed, to make sure that those drugs were as safe as possible, to assess to evaluate the benefit and the risk around those drugs, and then once the drugs came to market, to ensure their safety by looking at how they were being used, if they were being abused, for instance, at overdoses, or just the body's reaction to that drug, and if it was problematic.
Okay, and we've got just about a minute and a half here before we go come to the news break, and we'll come back. But you know, you mentioned this a couple times in the what you did and the movies we've seen or the TV shows we've seen. I think we hear epidemiology in a series of pictures of whether Dustin Hoffman playing some character or in a movie. But you talked about mathematics and modeling. That's not the action movie sequence. I mean, how much of the job is you're sitting in there in one of those, one of those super PPE space suits, and how much of the time are you just working with data?
Right. So there are individuals who are strictly data analysts, and they're mathematicians. They do modeling, and that's a very important function for public health. My role was not really aligned with that. So I'm a therapeutic epidemiologist, so I was more boots on the ground doing some tracking of syphilis and HIV in the Birmingham area, certainly boots on the ground in South Africa and China. So you're right, Sean, that's a great distinction. But epidemiologists come in many sizes and areas of expertise. And mine tends to be toward more of the practical and therapeutic side.
All right. Well, we come back from the break. I want to hear about that frontline experience there and boots on the ground and what this means for us back home as we talk about COVID-19. We continue our conversation with Dr. L. Scott Chambers with the Mobile County Health Department. And your questions as well. You can text questions into 343-0106 as you hear. He's got the chops to answer them. So bring them up. Let's talk some COVID. Let's talk about dealing with COVID. Let's talk about therapeutics. Let's talk about a vaccine.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Continue our conversation with Dr. L. Scott Chambers with the Mobile County Health Department. And the best thing to do, too, is get some new information here as y'all are tallying numbers for Mobile County. Dr. Chambers, what do the numbers look like today for COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations and all the other subsets?
Sure. So just to give a little bit of background, what we do is on a daily basis, we run counts on new cases, those that are hospitalized, and the number of fatalities that have been reported in terms of that are COVID-related. And then we also do some trending over time. But as of this morning, August 20th, 2020, is what we're looking at. We have 11,546 cases of COVID-19 cumulative, and that's a one-day increase of 135. So those of you that have been following the data, you guys see that is above 100 for the first time in a couple of days. We were running daily increases that were, in the 50s and the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
We have 1,632 individuals that have been hospitalized total, and we had an increase of 16 between yesterday and today. And then our mortality figure is at 242, so we lost 5 residents from Mobile County in the last 24 hours.
As we look at the day-to-day, and somebody in your position can help us there. Is it bad to watch day-to-day? For me, not for you, what y'all are doing, but for me, or is a better sample 7 days, better sample 14 days? If we're trying to look at your dashboard and see trends, and do you have a suggestion, one where you think it's the best, getting the most current information, but getting a real sense of what's going on?
Great question, Sean. So if you do fixate on the numbers day to day, then that's not going to be informative because there are biases in the numbers. The problem is in the way that the number of cases are often reported, there's some lag in the numbers. So for instance, we may have a lab that will sit on some numbers and then they report them all at one time. And all of a sudden, you'll get a spike of 500 cases where we have been running, magnitudes lower. And that, if you would look at that normally, you would think, oh my gosh, what has happened? But if you will focus on the 14-day moving average and on our COVID report, we typically will display that in green, and then there is a 7-day moving average. And so those really tend to smooth out some of the funny things that can happen with the day-to-day count. That's what I would direct your listeners to.
So that's the best place to get a real sense. And I know there's probably every case is specific, but the reason labs would sit on this, I mean, I was asking this of Dr. Murphy before as well. Why do you hear any, is there any good reason that they would sit on numbers?
Well, so let me make a distinction between the day that the patient or individual is tested and then when that result comes back. And I'm sure you guys have heard where sometimes there's, you know, 12 to 14 day delays in that report. Now, they're getting better, but the lab has to wait until they get reagent to do the PCR testing. And that, you know, many times means that they're sitting on these samples, and then they can run the samples once reagents are available, and then you get the spike. A better way of looking at this is actually looking at the case infection date, which is when that case actually submitted the sample, and we then have to look in retrospect from when the lab reports out to when that patient presented the data. And if you use that date, it's much, much better to smooth the curve. The problem is here is that, you know, the Band-Aid, you know, in the presentations of data have been kind of been out there for a while. And so to turn that ship and to start reporting differently ultimately may cause more issues than benefits.
It's refreshing to hear you say that, because it's something that we've been wondering here, right? And Dalton and I have been talking about this and saying, well, we have to get, you know, maybe we could do this better or reporting. But the question is, yes, do you at this point undo it or maybe one day go back and audit this? I want to run to a couple other questions. Questions are coming in pretty steadily here. So I want to talk, first of all, about where you see trends going, and you talk about the trend for 7 or 14 day, but what does that tell you what to expect as you model, like you talked about modeling going forward? Do the numbers you see in a 7-day trend now tell you something about what you expect to see in 2 weeks?
It gives us an indication, but numbers in themselves in isolation won't give you the full story. And so I think the best example right now would be the number of kids going back to school, so for in-person learning. So in our area, I believe all school districts in Mobile County are open with the exception of the Mobile County Public Schools.
Right.
So we expected and could project that we were going to see an increase in the number of you know, school-age kids testing positive, and that's exactly what our data showed. What was interesting, if we look historically, you know, the number of individuals in the 65 and older age group had a much higher percentage of those testing positive and were, in terms of absolute numbers, you know, very, very high compared to some of the other age groups. That was a function of testing, because early on we were testing those that were most at risk, which were in the older age group. What's interesting now is we're seeing that change over to, you know, the 25 to 40 age group roughly. And when I look at my time trends, you know, they're the ones now that are showing us the most cases. So, you know, what we do with the numbers and thinking about the future is we look at what's happening in the community, looking at bigger events, population mixing, you know, football coming on, for instance. Large entertainment venues now starting to open up for concerts, movie theaters, that type of thing. And that helps us understand what our numbers are showing. The other thing, though, we get emails from probably many of your listeners, is that they very often will point out things to us that are very astute. So if you look at the trending right now, the total number of cases are going way down. But the total number of tests are also going way down. So what for us was problematic is, well, where the heck are these people going to get tests? And that was because a change in the system where people were going to get more of the rapid test, where you can get the answer back in 15 minutes versus, you know, 10 to 14 days in some cases. And we don't think we're getting all that data back. So when I look at these really low numbers, I know that masks are helping. I know that the people of Mobile County, you know, are socially distancing, and that's having an effect. What we don't know is that channeling into the rapid test and us not seeing the data, what that really means for our numbers and what it holds for the future.
Wow. All right, we're coming right back from the break, because that's... Those are things, I mean, can you imagine? I mean, this man has had to deal with the numbers. Dalton and I have been talking about it. If you get one part, you get data coming in on one part of this, but don't have the other side of it, how you try to balance that out. Also, we're going to talk about therapeutics out there, vaccines, and see if Dr. Chaver thinks we're in a first wave, second wave, or it's just one wave. We'll ask that when we get back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile, continuing our conversation with Dr. L. Scott Chavers of the Mobile County Health Department. I want to... Actually, I've got a stack of... I have so many questions of my own, but listeners first, as always. So let me get this. Dr. Chavers, first of all, this question here. Doesn't the common cold show positive on a COVID test?
Great question. So there are two types of tests that are used. One test looks at components of the of SARS-CoV-2. That's the actual virus. It's an RNA virus that causes the disease COVID-19. So when you go to our testing truck that's out here in our parking lot or to many of the other places, what they're typically testing for is the virus. And what that shows you is that you've got viral particles within your body. The other test is the antibody test. And what that is it's looking for antibodies and not, I don't want to get into, you know, a big technical discussion, but basically what that is that your body has seen a SARS-CoV-2 virus, and it has formed antibodies to that, and the antibody test is looking for those antibodies. Now, what's interesting is that there are areas on SARS-CoV-2 that are similar to the coronavirus that causes the common cold. And so the antibodies, if they are made where they will attach to those common areas, it can give you a false sense of security that you have been exposed. So we do not, and let me repeat this, we do not use antibody tests to diagnose someone as being infected with COVID-19. Those tests need to be interpreted with a great deal of caution.
So that's where you could have the crossover for the common cold, or some other.
SARS-CoV-2. I'm not getting technical, but you know there are areas that are retained that are similar between the SARS virus that we saw in 2003 and the coronaviruses that circulate and we have been exposed to probably all our lives. So if we've got an antibody test that it finds an antibody, it may be due to SARS-CoV-2, which is the COVID-19 virus, or it could be for one of the older coronaviruses. So I just...
And so the antibody test, so people realize... Because what I've got... How about this? So everybody will know. The test I've gotten is the one where they take the gigantic Q-tip and go somewhere near the back of my head. That
yes,
test
doing
is
a brain op.
Yes. That one that makes me wrinkle my face up real funny. That's not what you're talking about. You're talking about the antibody test, which is
specific for antibodies. So if somebody's sticking what looks like a 2-foot Q-tip up your nose,
yeah,
that's looking for virus.
Okay.
Usually, when they are doing antibody tests, they're going to pull blood on you.
So That's so the flip side then, to if you did have, you know, the 2-foot Q-tip up your nose and looking for that, and it would it come back? Would it only be COVID-19, or could it be something else?
Very specific for COVID-19.
Okay. Let's talk about this question about what we was talking about, where we go next, and this will come into the discussion of vaccines, I know, and therapeutics, but Dr. Fauci and others have talked about waves, right? That this is coming in waves. You and I talked during the news break about looking at this, you know, purported video out of Wuhan, China, where they had a pool party dance thing going on. That looks like it's over. Where do you see us here? Stateside, do you think? Do you believe in waves? Do you believe in a constant up and down? What's your perspective on it, Dr. Chavers? Where are we, or can you tell?
Well, so I think we can learn from some of the epidemics and pandemics from the past. The interesting thing about this novel coronavirus, and it is novel because we have never seen it before. You know, there, as we talked about, there's some similarities between some of the other viruses that we've seen historically, but this coronavirus has a reservoir, which is animals in nature, for instance, that we believe, and I'm sure we're going to get questions about what, you know, was this thing invented in a lab, and we can talk about that, but it's most likely that this came from a bat reservoir. And we see that quite a large proportion of the viruses that we deal with, including flu, come from, they're considered zoonotic viruses. They come from animals. What that means for your question is it's impossible to eradicate a virus that has non-human reservoirs.
Because it can jump species again. We could knock it out of all people, but it could come from the animal world back into humans, right?
That's correct. So the way that the viral dynamics typically occur is that you get this influx of virus. So we, in this case, you know, SARS-CoV-2. And all those that are susceptible will and have sufficient exposure. So you do have to be exposed to a degree to actually being infected. But those individuals who are exposed, they do develop COVID-19. They may not show symptoms, but they do develop. And then they have the antibodies, at least for a 90-day period, based on the virology, they would be immune. So a virus will typically come through. It'll wipe out all those that are highly susceptible, and also have mediating factors like diabetes or heart disease that make the outcomes that we're interested in, so hospitalization or death, you know, it takes, so basically it creates an area of people who really can't transmit the virus. And then that's where you see the curves go down. As new people come into that area, then they become susceptible, and then they can transmit the virus. So this gets back to concepts like herd immunity, and basically the virus has to have humans for the most part to be transmitted.
You know, with the modeling and the mathematics that you do you see anything that I've just, this kind of conjecture on my part, but I want to put it against an educated mind, that as there are not, you know, the people have either gotten it and have that 90-day immunity or whatever it will be, or the people are quarantined. As there are fewer people, person gets infected with COVID, they now go into a crowd. In that crowd, instead of everybody being susceptible like they were before, now maybe only half, because people have antibodies or, you know, are resistant to the virus. And then that means only half of those people could pick it up and then repeat that. So then eventually it lose its legs that way?
I mean, yes. That's absolutely correct. So you may have seen this thing called an R value, which is basically, you know, the degree to which it's what it is. It's that measure on average, the number of people, a number of susceptible people that a single infected person can infect.
Okay, R value.
R value. So the number... So as you get more and more people with antibodies, that virus can't transmit typically to someone that has antibodies. And you're breaking the chain of transmission then.
So that does, I mean, it should, when that really starts to be widespread, it should start fairly precipitous drops, right, in the number of new cases. I mean, do you look for that?
It's possible, and absolutely. So, but I will say this. What has been estimated is that we need roughly 60% of the population to have this level of immunity to really stem this virus. The problem with this virus, it is highly infective. Now, it's not as infective as we see in measles and then in the old smallpox model, but it is a virus that can be transmitted much easier than some of the other viruses and certainly the bacteria.
All right. So with that being said, does that affect opinion for waves on this? I mean, when people, you know, talk about the wave, people going back to school and maybe another wave around holidays. Are the periods, use another science here, but the period of the wave shorter, or do you see any kind of modeling like that that has shown you that the waves will come and go faster, or they'll be longer and lower? Or what should we expect?
Well, if I knew that, exactly what to expect, I would be in a different position probably. But
I like it.
The thing about, so a way to think about this is an epidemic is built on, and I'm going to give you what we call the malaria model.
Okay.
But it works for this. So an epidemic and transmission is built on three nodes of a triangle. So the first node is the virus and how fast it can replicate, how it infects people. One of the problems with this virus is it can stay asymptomatic, just like HIV, and you can transmit. So that's one thing. We consider what's going on with the virus. The other node here is we think about the person. So you described immunity much better than I did and much more succinctly, but we have the degree of which people are immune. And then the third leg of third corner of this triangle is the environment. So as you push and pull on any one of those three areas, you change the viral dynamic in terms of transmission. So I'll give you an example. Back in the 1918 flu, and that's, if you're a historian and read that experience, it is one of the most incredible stories you'll read, because it talks, and you read this and you can say, oh my goodness, the same things are happening today. Now let me clarify, we're not talking about the magnitude of mortality that was in 1918, because we've got much better hospitalization resources and care, and our physicians are second to none in the world. But what happened back then is there were three waves. And this very well could happen with Corona. The things that were really changing was the populations changed. So that infectivity network and the number of susceptibles changed over time. The second thing that happened, though, was the virus. So the virus mutated just a little bit. And in the second wave, when it was reintroduced, the mortality that that you'll read about is from this immune response. It's a hyperimmune response from being re-exposed to the virus. And that has applications to the SARS-CoV-2 virus, because the damage it does is through the immune system. And the scarring that you see in the lungs, the enlargement of the heart, the GI issues, the blood clotting, the Kawasaki-like diseases, and there's a better name for it, but that you see in children, all that's immune-mediated. So as you think about what happens in the true next wave, so we're still in the first wave, and we are not out of it yet. It's difficult to tell if you look at areas like Wuhan and Australia and, gosh, New Zealand is a great example. No cases for 100 days. Now they just spike with the new outbreak. So looking at those and understanding the genetics of the virus is very, very important to find, to really determine if we've got a second wave or if we're still in the first wave.
Finally, somebody has been able to tell me the reasoning for it. That there's a lot of us, Dr. Chavers, been wondering how you would score that, and that's it at least gives us something to work off of. Before we run the break, I want to just talk for a second here on therapeutics, and then we come back and I want to talk about vaccines. But the therapeutics, okay. Lord knows, this is a minefield here politically, but I'm going to drop the politics out of it, and let's just talk some medicine. Dr. Chavers, okay. Hydroxychloroquine had come up first with the discussion. It's still back in discussions from time to time. What have you seen for that, the efficacy of that?
So there's two forms. There's chloroquine, which was in it was developed first for malaria. It had some issues in terms of toxicity. And then we had hydrochloroquine that came along, much safer drug. So its indications are for malaria, but it also is indicated for lupus. And I think that's where the biological plausibility started to be developed, because it was thought that because hydrochloroquine interferes with the immune response, then it could be beneficial in terms of dampening this immune response that's called the cytokine storm that was really causing the pathogenicity that you're seeing in a patient who doesn't do well. So there is biological plausibility there. What happened with hydrochloroquine is you had this biological plausibility. You saw this anecdotal evidence where it would work in some patients. And we can talk about this a little bit, Sean, about how drugs are developed and approved. Well, once there were randomized clinical trials, which is the pinnacle of scientific evidence in terms of safety and efficacy, we started to see, or the investigators started to see, where hydrochloroquine was not doing any better than the other drugs being tested. Now, I will be transparent that I have read the two studies that had issues with the data, and then I have read the other studies that are very, very large studies. And it doesn't appear that the risk-benefit for hydrochloroquine is such that you would want to use it against COVID-19. I am not here to say that it doesn't work for some people, but if you look at it as a medical treatment, given the risk of that drug, the observed benefit, it just does not raise to the standard of, for instance, remdesivir, which has shown a very different result in randomized controlled trial. I think the dexamethasone is probably the drug that's low cost. It's been around for 30 years. It's probably the drug that has the most potential right now in combination with some of the antivirals.
I want to talk more about remdesivir when we come back, and also talk about the big one here, the V word, the vaccine, and where we may be going with this. We'll continue our conversation with Dr. L. Scott Chavers from the Mobile County Health Department. And your questions here, you got one last segment to get them in at 343-0106. I got a stack of them here we'll get to when we get back.
With Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right back to our discussion with Dr. L. Scott Chavers with the Mobile County Health Department. And we talked about therapeutics here. So you said remdesivir, and you had added another part to that too, what you think is the best right now in therapeutics. Is it remdesivir or the other one you just named?
Dexamethasone.
Those are, yeah. Do you think they're equal, or is it some better for different people, different, how do you pick one from the other?
Yeah, well, so one, so remdesivir is an antiviral, and it was developed really for Ebola and hepatitis A. Did not do very well in the clinical trials for those two viruses, but has shown some good activity with COVID-19. So the issue with remdesivir, and I will say that federal government and the state of Alabama has been doing an incredible job making that drug available. But it's expensive because Gilead, who owns that, is now starting to charge for it. So it's about, I don't know, $2,500, $3,500 for a two-week course, where dexamethasone, which works in terms of blocking the immune system, drug that's been around forever, reduces inflammation, cuts down on some of the other aspects that worry about, but inexpensive, and in terms of what you're looking for in terms of public health, that's where you would want to go. Now, consult your physicians on this, because there's timing involved in terms of when this drug is used, because there's two parts of SARS-CoV-2 infection, and if you use the drugs at the wrong time, you can do more harm than you do good.
All right, let's quickly, just a minute left here, vaccine, Operation Warp Speed, companies out there. This idea of having a vaccine by the end of the year or early next year, it seems like Manhattan Project to me.
Yeah, so the fastest vaccine we have ever gotten to market was 13 years. That was one of the combined pediatric vaccines. We had the benefit of knowing how each of the components worked. This is just so out of the box. And let me just say, what Operation Warp Speed does is it has removed some of the risk from the pharma companies in terms of developing the vaccine. So there are manufacturing processes, for instance, particularly when we talk about an RNA virus or a vaccine or a DNA vaccine, that are very, very complicated. They're at high risk for a pharma company. And Operation Warp Speed has offset that cost of manufacturing. They're allowing for combining of phase one, phase two trials, which again speeds this forward. The issue that I'm seeing right now in the latest research is, the Moderna vaccine, which is an RNA vaccine, and if it ever makes it to market, will be the first RNA vaccine ever to make it. They need 300,000 participants. By the way, if you want to enroll in that trial, go to clinicaltrials.gov and you can get information on how to enroll. But right now they're sitting about 60,000. They need 300,000, and that's not an unusual number for vaccine research, but it's still got to be tested.
We got to update that. I'm up against the end of the hour. Yeah. Everybody got it? No, I'm sorry. I wish we didn't have we had many more hours. Can you come back and talk with us soon?
I would be happy to do so.